You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network. All right, it's Grant Nation time right now. Let's see if you can make this happen. Oh, sounds like he's there.
Morning, Grant speaking.
Grant Newsham joins the program this morning. Grant, a very good morning to you in Hawaii. How are you?
Oh, fine, thank you.
All right. We have a whole series of things to discuss with you. Are you ready for it?
Okay, yeah, fire away.
All right, I hope you had your coffee and you're on your A game because... I'm going to hold you accountable for this, okay?
Okay.
All right. You had a piece talking about Japanese and South Korean relations, and the Japanese, I'm the impression that based on a deal that they had about the whole issue of comfort women during World War II, but this seems to not be – this seems to be an issue that doesn't go away. Talk about that, and what are the prospects that at some point they can get beyond this decades-old festering wound in order to work together on clearly the compelling, more than compelling mutual interests that both of them have. So, can you explain the history first, and then talk about bring us up to, and then interject. The background, and then what's going on today, and the implications for future policy.
Okay. The article I wrote deals with the so-called comfort women and the comfort women scheme, which was a series of military-run brothels which the Japanese government and the military and civilian entities put together in World War II to service Japanese troops overseas. And it was staffed with many Korean women. There were also Chinese women, Filipinos. There were even some Japanese. And this has, in recent times, has become a source of animosity and friction between, particularly between Korea and Japan. The Japanese have tried to apologize for this several times over the years. They've given money to sort of an organization that supports former comfort women, all of whom are very old now, and there's not many left. But it has stayed an issue between Korea and Japan that won't go away. And most recently, for about probably the third or fourth time, the Japanese government thought they had a deal with the South Korean government that the matter would be resolved. Japan apologized, and they paid about $8.8 million to a new fund to support the comfort women. That was under the previous South Korean president, Park. The most recently, President Moon, the new president, he basically said, well, this is a bad deal, it's flawed. We need to change it. And the Japanese, of course, are quietly furious. And the Koreans are not. Moon just said just 2 days ago that, okay, I'm not going to destroy the deal or throw it away. But I still don't. He basically said, I still don't think you Japanese are serious about this when you say you apologize and the problem will remain. So what the Comfort Women Scheme does is it really typifies the bad relationship between Korea and Japan, which prevents real military cooperation between Japan and Korea, South Korea, and the United States. The Americans have been trying for years to get the South Koreans to cooperate, to do things with the Japanese and the Americans on a trilateral basis or even a bilateral basis. The South Koreans just cannot bring themselves to do it. And as a result, instead of having a more united front, a more coordinated effort to challenge North Korea, to take on the North Korean threat and also to resist China. You have this current situation where the Americans are backing, underwriting the whole thing, trying to work with the Japanese to have a defense policy, a defense capability, and then working with the South Koreans separately. And except for some very grudging dealings militarily between the South Koreans and the Japanese, there has been no real progress or success. So it's this past resentment over the past, which ultimately drives South Korean behavior and thinking towards Japan, which undercuts the overall U.S. defense effort in the region, to my way of thinking. So I wrote an article basically telling the South Koreans to grow up, and there were some reasons for that, and get over it, not quite in those terms. But I did point out the South Koreans are not exactly blameless when it comes to mistreating people either. So that was what the article was about. Though will it have any effect? I doubt it. It's about like telling, take the Greeks and the Turks, telling the Greeks to like the Turks and the Turks to like the Greeks. Human nature is what it is, and this sort of resentment is hard to go away. But what it will require is the Americans to finally tell the South Koreans, one, to get over this. And it's either they cooperate or else they're not going to get U.S. support. There's something along those lines. It will take the Americans to to finally give the Koreans a choice, that they either grow up or else they take on North Korea and do all the dying themselves, not us. So that's where I stand on this issue. But it's an issue that's been around a long time, and it just has been very difficult to resolve.
If we fought a long war against the Japanese, and while we don't necessarily have comfort women in our bag relative to that war, we certainly had the treatment of our own prisoners of war. We had the war itself. We've been able to put that aside to work with the Japanese. Why? What is it in? Is it because we defeated the Japanese, and so we have that, and the Koreans didn't do that? And they were occupied and abused? Is there something in the Korean makeup that doesn't allow this thing to be let go and moved on for clearly more compelling issues?
Well, there's probably all of the above. I think you're right. The Americans, we were have just as much grounds to dislike the Japanese for the next 1,000 years if we wanted to have it.
Right.
With the Germans, there's no amount of apologizing that they could do if we wanted to play it that way. The Koreans, of course, were colonized by the Japanese from about 1905 until 1945. And were not treated well, of course. They weren't the only people who experienced that. But there is something in, I think anthropologists could probably answer this question better as to why is it that these resentments will not go away. One might consider, say, the Irish towards the English is a good example. It just won't go away, and everybody has an excuse why the English are, did this or that wrong, and why they are particularly evil. The Armenians, nobody thinks much about them, but they seem to make anger the basis of their existence, this resentment of the Turks and the wrongs that have been inflicted on the Armenians. But the South Koreans just cannot make it go away. And there is something in, I think one might fairly say, in the nature of this, of the, I might say, Koreans, that for some reason there is a difference of some sort, and it makes it hard for these feelings to go away. One can, of course, debate whether it's character or just experience, but also politicians have made an effort to keep this issue alive, and I would say particularly politicians have played this in South Korea, because I've been told by people who know the place very well, who've lived there a long time, that actually the comfort women issue doesn't resonate all that widely with the public, which I've always thought very interesting, because you would it does get a lot of attention, particularly from foreign reporters.
Right.
But it is something, and that is, I always thought that was useful to keep in mind, that the it's not really an issue that every Korean person wakes up every morning complaining about the treatment of the comfort women. A couple of things I would point out that are of interest is that when the Americans got to Japan in 1945 for the occupation, actually the Japanese government offered them something very much like a comfort women scheme, and for the Americans, the Allies. And the Americans basically did not say no. And pretty much something like a comfort women scheme was in place during the American occupation of Japan. So that's an issue. Plus and also just for some additional context, South Korea has always had sort of a domestic comfort women scheme, and a very active and lively one for a long, long time. In some ways, you know, whilst the whole experience was, like a lot of things in the 20th century, was unfortunate, it's not as if the South Koreans or the Americans are without blame in this particular issue. But it's one that it has come to become a real hindrance to an effective U.S., Japanese, Korean defense of Northeast Asia.
Do you think at the root of it is the fact that, I mean, to me, this makes sense to me, but some of the Armenians, right, and the Turks, the Armenians never conquered the Turks. The Koreans never threw off the yoke of the Japanese. Somebody else did that for them. Do you think it comes with not ultimately defeating your oppressor that this stuff lingers? What you said is probably right in terms of there's elements of all that. But it seems like these things linger. I'm of Irish descent, and I remember my grandmother saying, and she was first generation, born in California, but her parents immigrated from Ireland, and she said to me in the 60s, when I was probably 9 or 10 years old, she said, there isn't anything that's been done to the blacks in this country that the English didn't do to the Irish. And, I remember looking, and it was not only what she said, it was the way she said it. And she was one of the most gentle, loving people I've ever met in my life. But there, I don't know. I think there's a special place in people's hearts for wrongs that are never righted in terms of the mind of that nation that feels like it was wronged and oppressed for whatever. So interesting. Does how big of an impediment is this?
I think the comfort women issue, it's sort of a manifestation of this fundamental Korean dislike of Japanese that almost is just internalized. And so I think you could resolve the comfort women issue. Say if South Korea said, okay, I still think there's some very considerable limits on how far real South Korean, Japanese and American cooperation could go. But then again, you did have, and that was partly because everyone says just how deeply held this anti-Japanese feeling is. But it is possible that the right administration in South Korea could certainly make some very nice improvements in the relationship. And all it would take is some political leadership to do that. But in terms of a formal alliance, I'd be surprised if that ever happened. But really just some decent cooperation with the militaries, with the navies, with the Air Force, for example. And one thing that's interesting is that between the Korean military and the Japanese military, the self-defense forces, there's actually always been a pretty good relationship. And I think you still do. You have Korean Defense College or Command and Staff students actually come and visit Japanese bases to get to know, learn about the Japanese military. So there is, and at a certain level, there's always been sort of high-level business groups and and sort of political groups that even go over to Korea and have and get together and meet. Prime Minister Nakasone used to be very active in that. So there is a, you know, a certain amount of sort of call it decent feelings between Korea and Japan. But it's not really what you would call widespread, but without some real political leadership, it's going to be very difficult to move this too far forward. But that said, it's not impossible. But it depends on what time of day you think about it as to how optimistic one would want to be. But sometimes when you tell the South Koreans or give them a choice, that they kind of wake up a little bit. One recalls Donald Rumsfeld when he was Secretary of Defense, you know, dealing with some South Korean problem where they were being very difficult, said, okay, if you don't want us here, we'll leave, or something to that effect. And that woke the South Koreans up really quickly. And they suddenly did a 180 degree turn and became very cooperative. But Rumsfeld did what nobody thought you could do, was this, you know, the idea being, well, you can't talk tough to these people. And that seems to have driven much of U.S. policy for a long time, not just with Korea, but with everybody, is, oh, you mustn't say something because it will provoke them. But sometimes when you present people with a stark choice, that the saner people tend to make themselves heard on the other side.
All right. I want to go back in time a little bit, and I think it was months ago that you explained there's been a rash of aviation incidents on the island of Okinawa. Can you explain how can you explain Secretary Rumsfeld's role again in getting us off that island? I think you explained it to me the first time. Yes.
Yeah, well, what he did, it was his role in this thing called DPRI, which is the Defense Policy Review Initiative, which basically means move all the U.S. forces in Japan and Northeast Asia around so that there's less of them on Okinawa. And it's been this huge goat rope that has also has provided some very nice sinecures for some public servants. Without having produced much. When they've moved the furniture around where some Marines are going to move to Guam, some back to Hawaii, they've moved some air units to other parts of Japan. But ultimately, think of it as rearranging the furniture in your living room. But there was no real need to do this. But it happened because Donald Rumsfeld went to he went to Japan. And the governor of Okinawa said, well, I want to meet with him. Which would be like the governor of Wyoming, say, I want to meet with President Xi of China when he comes to America. But anyway, the Okinawan government said he wanted to meet Rumsfeld. And the American embassy, to their credit, and also the Marines advisor on Okinawa, the civilian advisor, who was very good, they all said, no, do not meet the Okinawan governor. It's not... one, it's not appropriate, and two, nothing good is going to come of this. But Rumsfeld, who always knew better than everybody else, decided that he was going to meet the Okinawan governor. So he goes down to Okinawa, and predictably, the Okinawan government launches into an attack on Rumsfeld, on the United States, complaining about the Americans, complaining about the treatment the Okinawans get, the fears, the worries about having American bases there. So Rumsfeld says, okay, if we're not welcome here, then we'll leave. We'll reduce or move, we'll move for a lot of troops or something. And that turned, what that led to is all of this effort that I've talked about to rearrange the furniture. And the changes that have been made really haven't been, they just haven't been necessary. And it's a lot of effort for not much. And it's also given the local Okinawans the sense that aggressive opposition, at least, the sense that if they just scream loud enough, they can get whatever they want, that there's no need for them to cooperate with anybody. And the Japanese government is, of course, continues to be terrified of the Okinawans. And this is so what it, it all comes back to that meeting Rumsfeld had with the governor. And a lot of the, some of the things that have happened regarding Okinawa in the last, I don't know, 15 years or so would not have happened had he not come and taken offense. So what you had with it was a, basically a foreign policy or defense policy driven by the notion of Rumsfeld taking offense at something instead of a considered look at the issue and talking to the people who understand it and could have advised him what to do. So in one of the things I wrote in that article was that a sort of a foreign policy based on resentment isn't a good thing. And I think Rumsfeld gives one small example of that in what happened with Okinawa.
Well, it certainly is. You know, every time something falls off an aircraft, again, which I don't poo-poo, I mean, that stuff shouldn't be falling off aircraft. But when you can't and don't provide for your own defense and somebody else is doing that, there comes a point in time when you need to shut up. And I dare say, what's going to happen, Grant, when the Chinese decide they will fortify islands, take and fortify islands in the East China Sea? That have been contested for decades, for centuries. And who did the Japanese turn to at that point? Their own military?
They turned to us. They probably called Donald Rumsfeld.
Hey, buddy, what are you doing these days?
Yeah, that's the, you know, it's the Americans who are expected to come and save the day. And if we somehow resist or are reluctant to do that, or to do what the Japanese demand of us, then the Japanese will, of course, take offense at this and that, of course, forgetting that they've been routinely criticizing and chastising us forever. Whenever these incidents happen, the vast majority of which are sort of the results of the normal happenings of aviation and flight operations, or even just the normal things that happen when young troops are in a foreign country, or in any country for that matter. And they've never quite understood, let's say, the U.S. side, how the U.S. might interpret all this constant criticism. You know, effectively saying, well, look, we don't like your behavior, we don't like the fact you're here even, but we like your blood so that we can, if we snap our fingers, we expect you to come the way you would if we call a taxi. You can see that I'm not exactly anti-Japanese, but that sort of argument doesn't go very far with me, and it's not going to resonate, I think, with a lot of the American public or the politicians either. So that's, but it, as you said, it's the Americans who are expected to underwrite and to save the day should Japan have any trouble in its southern islands with the Chinese or with anyone else.
All right. The North Koreans and the South Koreans, in something very, very widely publicized, entered into negotiations. Give us your take on all that. What we've seen in the modern in mainstream media is what we've seen in the mainstream media is that this is a tactic employed by the North Koreans whenever things may be getting towards difficult, and so it's a way to call off the dogs a little bit and play for time. I also and included in that when you talk about that, President Moon very publicly thanked President Trump. My apologies to Donald Trump for ever even mentioning confusing the two. He very publicly thanked Donald Trump for being very instrumental in making this happen. So your take on both those?
I think you characterized it correctly. We've seen this before. Often when there is a big sporting event, an international sporting event in Northeast Asia or Korea, South Korea, the North Koreans say they want to get involved in it, and they offer up the hope of the possibility of talks with the North-South Koreans to work something out so North Korean athletes can come. And as I said, we've seen this before, and once again, consider what have the results of that been. Not much. But that is what's going on, is that there's a couple benefits for Kim in this. Particularly, as we've never seen sanctions against North Korea have as much consistency as they're having today, and they are having some effect, which has caused some additional economic difficulties to North Korea. Anytime they offer to talk to the South Koreans and to get in, to participate in sporting events like this with the South Koreans, and there's an aspect of the North and the South cooperating, the South Koreans always just get really excited about it, and they start offering gifts and money and stuff. And so the North knows that it just might get some stuff and some money from this. But also it buys time. It creates this illusion that people in the South and elsewhere in the world are so willing to latch onto that, well, maybe this time it's going to work. This time they're going to work something out. And it shows the North really does want to resolve this issue and that we can talk it out. But we see this so many times over the years that one does well to pay attention to empirical evidence if you want to predict how this is going to turn out. But also what this does is it slows down this effort by the United States to really tighten the screws on North Korea by putting some distance between the Americans and the South Koreans, because the South Koreans are basically telling the Americans, look, hold off, back off, whatever you're doing, just give us a break here. Don't hold those military exercises during the Olympics. It's just one small concession. It's not a big deal. But the Americans, of course, who have been really serious about going after North Korea now, suddenly have to call a halt to things. Basically, that they cannot keep the pressure on. South Korea even starts to see the Americans as kind of a problem. It's because if they would, Americans would ease off, then the South Korean regime or administration thinks that it could deal with the North Koreans, maybe make a deal. Maybe there's an industrial area between that the two Koreans operated for a long time, that North Korea makes a lot of money from. Maybe that will get reopened. Maybe that will be the step which leads to resolution. So the South Korean regime is doing what at least two previous leftist South Korean regimes have done. And it's if not put a halt, it's certainly taken some of the momentum out, at least temporarily, of the U.S. effort to tighten the screws on North Korea. So I think we've seen this happen before, and can probably predict how it's going to happen again. And throughout all of this, the North Korean effort to develop better nuclear weapons, better missiles, that keeps going. So they've bought themselves some time to keep their development effort going unmolested, and these also put some distance between the Americans and the Japanese and the South Koreans, even though both the Americans and the South Koreans will claim that, oh, there's no change in our policy toward North Korea. But just by definition, there has been. And this is an unhelpful temporary halt. It's you might compare it to being in the waiting room at the dentist's office to have some wisdom teeth taken out. And the dentist or whomever tells you, well, let's hold off a while. Well, you're just so relieved not to have the immediate problem of your teeth taken out that you say, okay. But in the meantime, your wisdom teeth don't get any better. This is just anyone who's optimistic about this, I think, is deluding themselves.
Okay. I want to ask you about the B-2 bombers to Guam here in a second. Have you seen the movie Darkest Hour?
Yes, I saw that.
Okay. I did over the weekend. And I don't know that one can help drawing. First of all, If you haven't seen it, I would recommend it. I don't know what the Almarine Radio movie critic that I am. Two thumbs up. I enjoyed it. Grant, did you enjoy the movie?
Yeah, I thought it was excellent. In fact, when you watch it, there was something kind of contemporary about it. Because especially if you follow Asian affairs, because it reminded me of the, in some ways, of the experience people have had who've been warning about the Chinese threat for a long time and how they've been treated, and, you know, sort of abused and criticized and ridiculed. And, you know, one wonders if we've waited too long. And so I thought it was just, as I say, it was kind of depressing in a contemporary sense. But it was just an excellent story of that era and very well done. And also a reminder of what comes of appeasement. But it's, I think even people who don't like history much, I think might enjoy it. And if you do like history and even contemporary world affairs, I think it's an excellent movie.
We tend to think there's also a movie out about Dunkirk, but if you put yourself in Churchill's shoes, and Dunkirk is yet to happen. Dunkirk is kind of being conceived, but your staff officers from the Royal Army are telling you that we may be able to get 10% of the 300,000 out. And the Navy looks at you and they nod as well. The Germans own the skies. This is going to be extremely problematic for us, and we are pinned in to Dunkirk. And so you have a choice to negotiate with a honest broker like Benito Mussolini at the time, with Adolf Hitler. That is what the Brits face. You have the United States saying not so much. We're really not interested in coming and being involved in another European war. So it's very interesting historical problem that we don't tend to look at that decision point. We, you know, Dunkirk, you know, we see as this great success, and okay, well, they get their army back after Dunkirk, blah, 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 blah. Well, that's not when this happens. That's not when this decision gets made. And so I find it, you know, and at one point Churchill says, you cannot, words to the effect, you cannot negotiate or make deals with dictators. Yet we find ourselves, the United States finds itself in a position relative to with North Korea that is where we're at. And the appeasers, and I can hear Susan Rice talking, saying maybe we just need to learn to live with a nuclear North Korea. So do you see parallels between our appeasement and what Churchill faced in 1940.
Oh, definitely. It may vary somewhat, but it's the same basic issue that I think when Nehemiah was rebuilding the walls of Jerusalem back in Bible days, that it was very similar arguments used to get him not to do that, not to defend himself. But I think it is going back to World War II era. Yeah, I think we forget just how all the smart people said, well, there's nothing that can be done. There's no better policy. There's no better approach than in the 30s. It was appease the Germans, give them what they want, give Hitler what he needs, what he said, and then he'll be happy. And then once it got to about the time of this movie, when it got to Dunkirk and the defeat of the British and French forces, that all the smart money said, well, you can only get this many off the beach. It's hopeless. Let's cut the best deal we can. And, you know, just thank goodness Churchill did not do that. And I think actually that I'm told that by guys that follow this, that read a lot, that Churchill never really had the doubts about the need to oppose Hitler that the movie suggests, but he was always very clear about that. But it, once again, it is the, you know, one notes how all the smart people, and this really was, you know, Britain's foreign policy, its defense elite, the political world were all saying, or not all, but an awful lot of them saying, look, the game's up, we have to make a deal, it can't be helped. And it really was just this fortuitous appearance of a man like Churchill, and also the King of England played a very important role. Once he finally just got tired of things and basically lined up with Hitler. But it's very easy. The British could have cut a deal with the Germans back then. And if you look back, if you say you go back to about 2006 in the United States, and you look at the same arguments that have been used towards China, that have been used particularly towards the people who suggested there was an alternative approach, and it's familiar enough that it's just depressing in a way, because we've wasted so much time. And now we have to deal with a much more capable, a much more threatening China, which I think in some respects is actually a bigger threat to us than the Germans were in 1939 or 38 even. So it is a little bit depressing in a sense, but it is the human experience, I think, that this movie just captures so well. And it is history that sort of people our age, pretty familiar with. We're all familiar with it, and I think even people who aren't quite as familiar with it would do well to understand this lesson in sort of human nature, if nothing else. But it is a great story. You know, I'm old enough to remember when Churchill died, and is watching his funeral on TV. So it always seemed it didn't seem like watching a movie about William the Conqueror, Genghis Khan or something like that, that's so far back that it's a little hard to appreciate.
And I happened, last night, after dinner, I was watching TV, and as I was perusing the 600 channels that I get on DirecTV and finding nothing, I turn to Netflix, and I go to their documentary section, and Oliver Stone has his own history kind of anthology that he's put out. So I began watching the first one, and I fell asleep maybe halfway through it. But one of the things that, you forget Hitler's land grabs in terms of the road to World War II, it's not like they were moderate. It's not like they were moderate. So the Treaty of Versailles is signed, and then the Rhineland is essentially created as a demilitarized zone. Well, he occupies that, right? So no more DMZ. I've taken this back. Now, that might be a yellow flag in terms of monitoring the Treaty of Versailles. The next thing is the annexation of Austria, right? Met with parades and great fanfare by the Austrian people. And then after that, it was the Munich Agreement, the partition of Czechoslovakia. And so you look at that and you're like, wow. So the leaders of Great Britain, France, Italy, and Germany hold a conference in Munich to give Germany part of Czechoslovakia. And you look at that and you're like, and it just goes, again, the historical lesson of peace through strength is the only way to live. And when you decide that you as a nation are going to live contrary to that, I don't know what reality historically that you live in. And I was reading, so it's interesting. So I need to watch more of Oliver Stone's version of the world, but those steps towards 1940 and the German invasion of France that puts, England in a position that they're about to lose their army that's on the continent, and what will they do? So extremely interesting. But the appeasing dictators, I mean, the combined might of post World War I Europe was Germany couldn't stand up to it. Not even close. In fact, he quotes Hitler writing later that when he moved into the Rhineland, there was no way that he could have militarily backed up to that. If anybody would have stood up to him, he would have had to have left. But he did. But they didn't. So he stayed. And so it's just interesting in terms of appeasement that we see throughout history and that we deal with today. Bullies that bluff, whether it's Putin or whether it's North Korea. And so it's I find it very interesting study in national behavior. And it just seems very, very rare where somebody on the good side stands up and says, we're not having that. And if we need to go to war, then we'll go to war. But we will not live like this under these conditions by controlled by a dictator. So interesting. The significance of the B-2 bombers to Guam that is in the news this morning.
Oh, I don't think much. I think it's just being ready just in case. I don't think anyone's going to do anything. Just look at it as an insurance is all. You know, they move all over the place, and we've seen them move there before. I don't see it indicating the start of anything, but probably just sort of a warning or intended as a message to North Korea. Whether or not they get it or not, of course, is a different issue. But at least makes us feel good that we're sending messages. I just don't see much coming of it just yet.
Is it a gesture at least saying that even though we've agreed to postpone exercises till after the Olympics, which Secretary Mattis says is more logistical than anything else, simply not practical to be doing exercises when the security effort of the Olympics takes place and all the additional traffic in the nation. Is it simply, here's another card on the table, we are serious, we're not going away, we haven't forgotten, so more public relations in terms of answering, we're not going away, and we will sustain pressure? It seems to me more PR.
I think that's how you would look at it, and particularly in light of the postponement of the military exercises during the Olympic Games, what the South Korean move to allow the North to participate in this, the implicit, not stand down, but at least slow down of the U.S. Effort to pressure North Korea in conjunction with the Japanese and the South Koreans and allegedly the Chinese, but a number of other countries. When you look at all of that, it looks like the Americans are losing ground. And I think bringing the B-2 into the twos into the region, it suggests or tries to demonstrate that that we're just as serious as we've ever been, and this is going to continue. This effort against North Korea is going to continue once the Olympics are over. I believe there is some that word they use, messaging, involved here, but the messaging often works really well with us, not so much with our opponents. But that's just an observation.
No, well said. Well said. Here's an email. Mac, always enjoy having Grant on the program and hearing his perspective. Question, will, in his opinion, the North Koreans do anything during the Olympics? It's hard for me to imagine that they won't, given the fact that the eyes of the entire planet will be on South Korea at that time. Or does their athletes' participation in some way, shape, or form preclude them from doing anything crazy?
I think it's the latter. I don't think they're going to do anything. Partly that's, because they do have their people down there, but also, as I say, we've seen this before. And when they do get involved in these sorts of events, they generally don't do anything. In fact, they don't. They're on pretty good behavior, superficially. But so I think that's how this will play out. But I would ask, can anybody name any of the previous events where they participated in this? So the point is, it's very hard to.
Right.
Once the Olympic Games are over, wait a couple weeks, and I think everybody will have forgotten about this. But it will take us a while to get back up to speed in what we've, particularly in getting the South Koreans to cooperate with us and what we're trying to do to protect them. So I think we're actually probably got a sort of a few weeks coming up where we can actually kind of not breathe easier, expect nothing, or we can expect, I think, a fairly calm time and the North not to do anything. I could, of course, be wrong, But that would be my my prediction based, and fortunately we've got 25 years of sort of evidence or experience to try and predict what's going to happen, say, in the next month, and that would be my guess.
All right, two interesting emails. One is about that. Mac, I read yesterday, I think it was in Reuters someplace, that the Chinese were contemplating slowing their buying of American treasuries, which sent a tremor through the financial world. Did Grant see this? And if not, what does he make of the idea, which I think most people have considered as another Chinese weapon in this war that we fight, that we try to pretend that it's really not a war and that we're friends? So I saw that yesterday. Did you see that, Grant?
Yes, I did. My take on that, and it's not the first time we've heard this,
right,
that the one might, one almost wishes Donald Rumsfeld was around. No, I'm joking.
Oh, my God. Slap yourself. I know it's early, but take a drink of coffee, for God's sake.
Somebody with that nature, you know, tell the Chinese, okay, go invest it somewhere else. They don't have many other good places to put their money.
Okay.
And they do raise this issue every now and then as sort of a veiled threat at the United States. And sometimes there are some, I don't know if you call them technical, you know, there may just be some business reasons not buy as many bond U.S. Securities as they usually do. And that does fluctuate over time. You know, it's not as if they always buy the exact same amount on a regular basis. But the amounts they buy or sell does vary, but ultimately they don't have any really good place to put their money. If they ever do, then I think we would do well to be a lot more frightened. In about 1998, it was Hashimoto, who was the prime minister of Japan. I'm not sure if he was finance minister at the time, but it was around 1998 or so. He actually threatened to do the same thing. And the fear of, particularly Japan and now China, unloading U.S. Treasury bills has always been around, and it's been discussed as, you know, this potentially disastrous thing that could happen. And, it may be someday, but I don't see it just yet. I don't see the Chinese having a good alternatives to this yet. But that would just be my reading of it. And as I say, it's like a lot of things. If you've seen it happen before, it gives you some idea of, you know, how concerned to get. But let's say I don't see China wielding this as a weapon yet, but they would if they thought it was to their advantage, but I don't think they do yet. But it does point out once again the responsibility that our side has to get its economic house in order. And we are slowly committing suicide if we don't start living within our means paying down this debt. That's been an issue for a long time, but it's not going away, and it gets almost exponentially worse the longer we postpone it. So while the Chinese and any other enemies we might have who hold a lot of T-bills do have some leverage over us, I don't think the Chinese can use it much as a weapon just yet. But at the same time, as long as we make ourselves vulnerable, we're as much to blame for this as anybody else.
Mac, I'm curious if Grant has any thoughts on the issues involving Seventh Fleet. He's been in the Pacific and observing it for a while. The issues that plague the Seventh Fleet are to varying degrees exhibited in the other fleets, but none of them have had the problems that Seventh Fleet has. I enjoyed your interview earlier this week when the discussion came up. I'm curious if Grant has any thoughts on it. Yeah, Grant, any thoughts on the Seventh Fleet?
Of course, speaking as a Marine, I can let me tell you about the Navy. But the
it never slows us down, I can tell you that.
My sense is that they really are overstretched. You know, they've got a lot. It's not like they're sitting around doing nothing. They're just really busy. They've only got so many ships. And it appears that, obviously, and whenever you do have an accident, generally there's a leadership problem in there somewhere. But it does seem as though that there's just inadequate training of the surface warfare fleet, and both at the sort of the enlisted level and the officer level. And I think if one tracks it back, you'd probably find the problem up in Newport, Rhode Island, or wherever they closed down that training school in the early 2000s, and as a way to leverage the .com boom, I think, and teach people with CD-ROMs and that sort of thing, instead of having them go to a difficult school where you actually train, learn how to use ships and operate aboard, and actually get just the more experience you get, the better. So you have the equivalent of, not the equivalent, you appear to have young ensigns showing up at their first ship. And the idea is that the captain of the ship is going to train them, as opposed to coming from a decent school that teaches you how to do this. And that is a fundamental fleet-wide problem. I think it may be exacerbated in Seventh Fleet's case because they are so busy, but also there must just be some bad fortune that they've had to have these kinds of incidents. But I would track it back all the way up to the CNO, or you know, somebody's responsible for having inadequate training for ship drivers in the Navy. And it's not leprechauns, and it's not a fleet commander either. I think it does need to go track up to the CNO, and I'd bring back the three or four before him and do something to them. I think one comparison one would make, and I found this useful to think it as a way to conceptualize it, is if you say you're a Marine and you're an artillery officer, and instead of going to Fort Sill after the basic school and learning how all about guns, you go directly to an artillery battery, and the expectation is that the battery commander will teach you. I think one sees the shortcomings in that approach, and that appears to be what the Navy has put in place. So you combine that with being busy, some questionable leadership, and not having a whole lot of, and they don't have a lot of ships out there, that you're going to have accidents like this. But once again, I would tend to look at the CNO if I was looking, and previous CNOs and the boneheads who got them into this fix, if I was seeking to diagnose the problem.
I don't buy the we're too busy argument. I've deployed for years. You know, we're talking about, you know, they go to sea. We're talking about between port visits, for God's sakes. It's not like they're driving around the Indian Ocean or the Pacific or for 7 months straight like we do when we go to war. And, you know, and I'll tell you what, working, you know, if you only worked 100-hour work weeks on our deployments to Iraq and Afghanistan, that would be wonderful. But you don't. You work more than that. 100 hours a week is 14 hours a day. Okay, that leaves you 10 free hours a day. Now, most of the guys that I know, most of the Marines that I know, male and female, they didn't work 14 hours a day. They work more than that. And so when I see Senator McCain saying, this has got to stop, well, shut up, man, go away. And this has gone on. I think John McCain needs to go away. I think he's part of the problem. This has gone under, gone on. This Navy thing has gone on under his watchful eye. The Navy has redefined themselves. They have less ships. They've done all these things. And they've slowly but surely civilianized themselves. And the stories that come out, there was one in Navy Times about the USS Antietam and the search that they did for a guy, that sailor that was missing for a week. They thought was overboard or they commenced an overboard search, but he was hiding in the engine compartments. That is, you read that, and his evaluations, even though he said he used to tell other sailors that he could shoot lightning bolts out of the palms of his hands. He's crazy. His fitness report said, exemplary sailor, must promote now, stuff like that. right? The chiefs conducted a search of the ship, and they didn't tell the officers. Another sailor saw him, had a conversation with him, and didn't report it because he was afraid that, Mims would kick his ass or something. And so you see this thing, and you're like, man, their problems are so significant. And anybody who's falling asleep on watch, and that happens, there ought to be a supervisor, a leader that looks and says, hey, McNamara, go to bed. Somebody go get me Newsham, all right? And McNamara, you're going to be in my office at this time. And we're going to find out why you can't sleep. Because most of the time with your 10 free hours, it's that when you get off, you go play video games and you go watch movies. You don't go to sleep. And there's a leadership component in there. And I think the Navy has lost its way. And I'm very anxious to see how Secretary Mattis handles all of this. And I don't buy for a second they're too busy. They haven't even gone to war, for God's sakes. You know, Naval Aviation has. Right, the carrier battle groups have, but everybody else, they've been driving around the Pacific, going to port calls, and doing their thing, taking their advancement tests, and being, you know, living the adventure. Well, you know, the rest of us went to war, so I think that they have a cultural problem. I think they have a huge cultural problem, and they're not about operating anymore. They're about being open and harassment training and sexual assault training. And I bet all of that in every one of those units is 100%. But can you go to sea? Can you navigate? Can you navigate? Can you drop the anchor? Can you hoist the anchor? Can you drive the ship without bumping into people? In the 7th Fleet, the answer to most of those questions is maybe, but probably not. And I'd be curious if we factored in the near misses, what you'd have, you know. So anyway, just a thought. I've got another. Do you have any closing comments on the 7th Fleet before I ask you a question about the Silk Road?
No, I'm not as, you know, I'm not sure there's that unique, but I would note, and the busy, your point about being busy and stressed is well taken. I think that is what militaries do. They're supposed to be busy. They're supposed to be stressed. But perhaps where one might describe this, is if you've got a training problem where you've inadequately trained your people, and they're supposed to the ship is supposed to train them, that once you do get busy as they are, that there's no chance that decent training is going to take place. So that's where I might just throw that in, that you've really set yourself up to fail, and then by this not having enough ships and being as busy as you are, you know, the last thing on the list that will keep getting to the bottom of the list is, well, let's get these people trained. It'd be just my speculation there, but your point is well taken.
All right. I read and I watch, and I enjoyed this discussion because I enjoyed discussions about leadership and institutions and how they deal with issues and things like that. Especially, you know, again, as Marines, you're kidding yourself if you don't think that these issues exist in the Marine Corps, right? I mean, I have two sons. I hear stories, right? We don't field day anymore. We don't inspect field day. And if you're going to be late for formation, you send a text. We, for generations in the Marine Corps, have been taught to go to war by the way we are in garrison, right? We learn in the field, yes, but the way you are in garrison, the fact that you inspect, the fact that you pay attention to chicken shit like MNU on war belts, the fact that you inspect field day, that the first sergeant and the CO both go there, that the gunny reports to the CO what he's going to find up there, and then he turns around and lays the wood to the people who didn't fix what he told the CO was going to be fixed last week. All that chicken shit, that accountability, that kind of inspecting, that punctuality, all of that it trains you to go to war. And when you abandon that, you do it, and I've seen it firsthand. When you're less disciplined, more people are going to die. And it's simply that simple. And so to me, why this discussion is important is that it is about discipline. And young people today come from a world where the most oft-asked question is, how did that make you feel? Man, I never got asked that. Hey, tell me how this feels on your ass is what I used to get asked, like most of us, right? So anyway, but I enjoy it, and I think it's going to be very interesting because Secretary Mattis is about discipline. It's about being brilliant in the basics and all the rest of that. And he sugarcoated a lot of it as he makes his trips around and he tells his little stories. But it'll be interesting when he gets his crack at what the Navy comes up with in terms of how they get themselves pointed in the right direction. So, I have a question about Silk Road. Mac, I've attached a link to an article that you can ask Mr. Newsham about. It comes from the economictimes.indiatimes.com. Headline, China's Silk Road hits a $14 billion pothole in Pakistan. Let me read the first paragraph. Beijing. China's plan for a modern Silk Road of railways, ports, and other facilities linking Asia with Europe hits a $14 billion pothole in Pakistan. Pakistan's relationship with Beijing are so close that officials call China their, quote, iron brother. Despite that, plans for the Daimar Bahasha Dam were thrown into turmoil in November when the chairman of Pakistan's water authority said Beijing wanted an ownership stake in the hydropower project. He rejected that as against Pakistan's interests. China issued a denial, but the official withdrew the dam from among dozens of projects being jointly developed by the two countries. From Pakistan to Tanzania to Hungary, projects under President Xi's signature Belt and Road Initiative are being canceled, renegotiated, or delayed due to disputes about cost or complaints. Host countries get too little out of the projects built by Chinese companies and financed by Chinese loans from Beijing that must be repaid. In some areas, Beijing is suffering a political backlash due to fears of domination by Asia's largest economy. Your thoughts on that? Interesting article.
I hope it represents a trend, but I'm not sure. But you do find, and it is a good article, and this is something I hope people are really studying in the government, but it represents this economic rapaciousness of the Chinese, that they basically see the world as a target and come in with a lot of money, throw a lot of bribes around, convince a government, our ruling class, or the rulers to sign up for these huge infrastructure projects, promising all sorts of wealth and benefits for the country and some nice money in a Dubai or Hong Kong bank account for the rulers. And then when there's obviously no way that the country can repay it, the Chinese say, okay, well, we'll basically do the equivalent of repossessing. Well, we'll take ownership of whatever it is, a port, an airfield, a dam, as the case may be, and it's ours now. And or we'll sign a 99-year lease for this, or whatever it is. And but it's naturally going to provoke some resentment. One hopes that it becomes more widespread and that it happens more quickly. But there certainly are these anecdotal bits of information about local resentment of China, the Chinese MO. And the Pakistan story is a good one, but it's important to look at the larger issue of Chinese involvement in Pakistan. And this dam project is just one of a number of things the Chinese have going, in addition to the port down in Gwadar, for example, and all these things have a military use, for them. And the Chinese understand this, and that's the long-term intention. But one wonders at what point the local reactions are going to turn against the Chinese, and this new form of Chinese colonialism that differs only in the specifics from what the West did in the 19th century in Africa and Asia and elsewhere. I'm not sure that it's, the trend is against or is a reaction against the Chinese, because there still is, think a lot of, they're having a fair amount of success in getting themselves ensconced in a number of countries around the world. They've recently signed an agreement with Georgia, for example, to rebuild Georgia's port on the Black Sea, which is not a good thing. They signed a free trade agreement with Moldova right up against the EU the other day. So, as you say, it's interesting, but does it reflect wishful thinking on our part, or is it really a turn of the tide against China's efforts to expand its power and influence through the so-called Silk Road, the One Belt, One Road project? You know, it's worth monitoring. It doesn't, of course, help if there's these countries, you know, who are presented with Chinese cash and corruption, if they have some alternative. And that's where I don't think the United States government is using the full sort of economic might of the United States to offer a better alternative to what the Chinese con men / mafia are offering to these countries.
So we went through this with the Soviet Union. Go ahead and hop in bed with them. See what happens. It generally doesn't turn out well for you.
It usually takes some time for that to right. play out. You know, we could help it along, particularly if we were to say offer some alternatives. You know, why couldn't we have redone George's port? Why can't we should be exposing the corruption involved in all of these things and trumpeting it to high heaven. And, you know, let these countries defend themselves. But we, for whatever reason, we don't do much. I wish we would, but it is important to look at, say, the big picture, because the Chinese do put down a lot of bets, seeing what's going to pay off. And then where they have, looks like they can have to make some progress, then they'll push with that. So even if they fail in a couple projects in a couple places, they're still, say, moving forward or moving outwards, is how it looks to me. So that I would read the article with that in mind, is one, look at the whole map and look at everything they're doing. Because I think they still have got some forward momentum. Unfortunately.
My guest this morning, if you don't recognize his voice and you don't listen very often, but it's Grant Newsham, got up early this morning to join us. So, Grant, the general article now, is there anything else that you need to get off your chest that I have not been savvy enough to ask you?
No, it's just I want to remind you that what the English have done to the Irish, so that you never forget this. No, I couldn't resist that.
Well, you know, the great thing for me is that I'm not Irish. Je suis American, right? I'm American. I'm a Native American. Now, I know that doesn't play well in some places, but I don't know what else to call myself. I'm not Irish. I don't celebrate St. Patrick's Day. I look at St. Patrick's Day with the same view that I look at Cinco de Mayo. It's the exact same for me. I celebrate the 4th of July. I'm American. To the Irish, I would say, if you would have stopped drinking, got out of those pubs, and done a little fighting, maybe you would have thrown their asses off your island that you owned about 1,000 years before you did it. Not saying, just saying. Being drunk for centuries is not a good thing. And then why writing poetry? Please, go grab a rifle. Go do something. So, anyway. Yeah, I don't, my friends used to hate me. McNamara, Michael Francis McNamara. Mac, what are you doing for St. Patrick's Day? Nothing. Why? Well, we're going to go to the Blarney Stowe in Fredericksburg. Yeah, have a good time. I'm not going to that. Oh, you don't want to? No, I don't like those whiny ass songs. Blah 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 blah. I'm American. I'm not Irish. They're like, you're going to hell. You're Irish. You can't deny your Irish heritage. Well, like, what the hell? I've never been to Ireland. Ultimately, now I've been to Ireland twice. On my way to Iraq, on two separate occasions, we stopped at Shannon International Airport, and I spent a grand total of maybe 2 hours, maybe 3 hours on the ground in Ireland. So I have been there. It's a green. It looks green. Got a lot of fences there, and that's about what I know about it. And I have other people in my family were from there. I know nothing about Ireland. So
okay, well I couldn't resist, but
all right.
I won't tell your grandmother.
She would not. She might care. She might care. All right, Grant. Have a wonderful day. Appreciate your insight today.
Okay, thanks very much.
You can find them writing in Asia Times. And we normally try to either retweet or somehow or other include his what he does in our work. So Grant Newsham, always interesting to have him on. Yeah, if you didn't hear the news of today, V2 bombers, three of them sent to Guam. My own opinion, and Grant said it as much, is that's simply just maintaining your boot in whatever position we have relative to the neck of the North Koreans. And I think it's incredibly important that people don't get squeamish. And it's hard for me to say this because where my two sons are, but if you appease dictators, history has taught us that you will only fight a larger conflict later. That is the lesson of history. So we'll take a break. More of All Marine Radio coming up next on a Thursday edition. We'll check some news headlines. And then hopefully Mikey Musselman will join us. But I don't know. I haven't heard from him. So we'll see. We'll see. So don't touch that dial. More of All Marine Radio coming up next right here on your home for it, the All Warrior Radio Network.
America's injured and critically ill service members face incredible challenges every day of their lives. Since 2004, the Semper Fi Fund has helped thousands of service members and their families with both immediate and long-term needs. Join the Semper Fi Fund in supporting American heroes. They've given so much. Now it's our turn. Learn how your tax-deductible donation makes a real difference in their lives at SemperFiFund.org.
All you veterans, listen up. This is Bob Nielsen, former Marine and founder of 100 Entrepreneurs Project. Turner Construction is looking for veterans with real-world leadership experience to join their team of professionals.
Hold on, Nielsen. Are we talking about a job or a career?
Mac, Turner Construction is a great company with global opportunities for veteran leaders who are looking to start professional careers. I know. I returned to Turner after I got back from Vietnam and retired after 50 years. I had a great career traveling the world leading teams of Turner employees as we built incredible projects.
Are they looking for me to have construction experience, Bob?
Absolutely not. Turner is looking for leaders who have led under pressure. We want leadership. So if you're led in Iraq or Afghanistan or any other contingency, Turner Construction is actively looking for you.
So a career with competitive pay, good benefits, and a company seeking veteran leaders. That's what we're talking about.
Bingo. We're on the right road when a grunt can understand it. Good job, Mac.
I appreciate that there, Nielsen. How do I get the ball rolling? What do I do?
Just email your resume to jobs@allmarineradio.com, and I will personally contact you and we'll begin the process.
I love it. Turner Construction is looking for veteran leaders who are looking for careers to join their veteran-friendly team. Email Bob Nielsen at jobs@allmarineradio.com. Let's do it. This hour of All Marine Radio is brought to you by our friends at Battle Mug, home of the world-famous Battle Mug. Starts as 10 pounds of aluminum. It's milled, machined, anodized, adorned with Picatinny rails, and then stamped with the serial number, and it's ready for you to make your own. Anything that went on your rifle or pistol can go on your mug. Scope, laser, camera, light. Put a lid on it, and you're ready for the field. If you're inside, add a flag and an emblem, and you're set. Perfect for any commemorative event. Farewell, promotion, retirement, birthday, anniversary, or get out of the doghouse. The Battle Mug is the perfect unique gift. Check out the entire line of product at battlemug.com. Enter the promo code Marine for 15% off. Battle Mug is a veteran-owned and operated company. The product is made entirely in the United States. Check it out, battlemug.com.
I'm an individual member. I joined the Global South Foundation because I believe in what it can do, and I also wanted to stay tied to the community that I was part of.
The benefits for individual members of the Global South Foundation are two things. One is networking, keeping in touch with the community, developing new relationships at any stage of your career. And secondly, it helps people stay abreast and up to date on the latest issues that the SOF community should be aware of.
The Global SOF Foundation is a great partner of All Marine Radio. Find out more about them at globalsoffoundation.org. /Marine.
MilitaryByOwner.com is an excellent resource for any military family moving to a new area. We found a ton of homes to choose from and purchased a house 8 days later. This was the only site I used. Thanks, Military by Owner.
Are you PCSing? Do you need to find a home near a military base quickly? With over 45,000 listings and 15 years of experience helping military families find, sell, or rent their home near a military base, MilitaryByOwner.com can help. Military by Owner. Proven and dependable.
We all have the ability to touch the lives of those around us. Moms, dads, neighbors, teachers, friends. These are the people who are always there to listen when we need to talk. Though their actions may not always be monumental, they are always felt. To someone going through a difficult time, a text, a call, or a visit can mean so much. Reach out to the veterans in your life today. Let them know they're not alone. One simple act can make all the difference. That's the power of one. If you're a veteran in crisis or know one who is, visit VeteransCrisisLine.net for free 24/7 confidential support. Or call 1-800-273-8255 and press 1.
You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network. John Wade, singing Missing You. Slowing it down for all you couples out there. On a Thursday. So let me read you a couple of emails. This is from Big Mike. What is the old saying? When you considered everything, sometimes the simplest answer is the correct one. The politicians that think that border security and illegal immigration are not linked are either one, incredibly naive because they have grown up in a country with very little real want, as they truly believe the United States will always survive, thrive, and will be like it currently is. Or, two, they are actively seeking the destruction of the U.S. and its current system. When you review the background of many of the individuals who push this agenda, they are Alinskys, Alinskyites, socialists. I think more folks fall into number two now, just my opinion. And you know what the, underpinning of all of that is? It's this assumption that that the economy is not going to grow anymore. Yeah. That 1 or 2% will limp along and we can't create jobs and blah, 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 blah. What are we finding out? Oh, when we put Americans first, that crazy things begin to happen that we don't really understand, you know? And I know it'll be spun negatively, but what, announcing 4,000 jobs in an auto factory in Alabama? What, Toyota, somebody else, joint venture, blah, 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 blah. And that I just saw another headline that somebody else announced that they were giving either bonuses or raises based on, you know, the changes of the tax law? You know, we have lived another way for so long. People don't even know that, you know what? We, through competition, we can cure ourselves. So the assumption is that you can't, and so that the state has to provide for everybody. And then, but riddle me this, Batman, how does the state provide for everything when you choke off the economy? I look at these issues, I don't understand, but again, all you got to do is stand out there and say it. You don't have to back it up, because once you get to, once you get to the place where you can spin it the way you want it to, you never really have to sit down and have an intellectual discussion about, okay, so explain to me how this works. And you heard it in the pushback coming. Democrats, you spend money on everything, right? On everything, social programs, whatever. They don't bat an eye. So yeah, but let's just say $15 billion for a wall. That's too much. Oh, it increases the debt. Blah 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 blah. And they'll increase Medicare spending. They'll increase Medicaid spending, social programs, whatever. They don't care about any of it. So how does it work if you don't create, and what Representative Cuellar was pushing back on building more of a wall? You know, he said, look, you know, 40% of illegal immigration comes from visa overstays. Okay, we'll unscrew that. Unscrew that. You can come in here on a visa, but we have to put this chip in you. Yeah. So we can locate you when you overstay it. Yep, that's the way it goes. What? Yeah. Yeah, just make sure that you don't do anything to this chip, because it will expire, it will ping, it will give us your location, and we will come looking for you. Mm-hmm. That's the way that works. What? Yeah. So, again, it's just, I don't know. I read the news, and it stuns me. Here's another one. Thank you for your little European history lesson. I enjoyed that very much. I think we forget about the danger of appeasement as we look at the quote-unquote complex world that we live in. And there is but one basic truth relative to nations, and that is if you are weak, you are going to get played. If you are strong, things tend to go well for you. And if you are strong in numbers, and then in parentheses, meaning multiple nations, and you stand for freedom, then you can usher in an era for peace in the world. That the world sorely needs. We need our allies to embrace that, man. We need the Germans to have a strong army. Germans stand for freedom. Doesn't mean we have to use it. And again, the chances are, if you have it, if it's strong, if it can go, you won't use it. But if you don't have one, if it can't go, then guess what? You're probably going to wind up using that thing too much. All right. Let me just go over some news headlines real quick on our way to the top of the hour, and possibly a visit. That's right. With the one and only Michael Musselman, the Gunner. All right. We got a couple of things to talk about with Mike. Headline, Marines launch joint exercises with Japan amid Korea tensions. Those are taking place in Southern California, just so you know. Another headline, Trump says no big-ass fight looming, but top Marine disagrees. What? So we got the Commandant contradicting the President of the United States? On Wednesday, during a joint media appearance with Norwegian Prime Minister Erna Solberg, Trump was asked by a Norwegian reporter about comments made by Marine Corps Commandant General Robert Neller during a visit to Norway's Bernays Garrison days before Christmas. In remarks reported by Military.com, Neller employed Marines on rotation in the country to be ready for a big-ass fight at all times. I hope I'm wrong, but there's a war coming, Neller continued. You're in a fight here, an informational fight, a political fight, by your presence. The comments drew quick clarification from Marine Corps officials who said the goal was to inspire U.S. troops and did not refer to a specific threat. But they raised enough concerns to prompt questions during Wednesday's news event, which Trump dismissed them. Maybe he knows something I don't know, Trump quipped. We have a powerful military. We're getting more powerful by the day, but I don't expect that. Trump repeated his national security strategy of peace through strength and said he believes a buildup of U.S. military equipment and personnel will discourage potential adversaries from attacking America or its allies. I think we're going to have a long period of peace. I hope we do. That's my opinion. That's not the general's opinion, but I think mine counts more. Anyway, and again, the you know, General Neller's quote, and I'm sure he will modify it in the future, to say we may have a big fight coming. I'm not sure. Marine Corps finally fielded the SMA 2. Huh? I thought we're getting rid of the SMA, and we're going to the Carl Gustav. What's going on here? So that's we have a couple of gunner questions today, and one is a laser designator. So those are Marine Corps Times headlines. So not much going on. Marine Corps actually has been like flying under the weather here lately, right? And I dare say that, and it's something terrible is going to happen. And the early bird this morning, top five stories look like this. Number one, I need to get some music that goes with that. Turkey summons U.S. diplomat over Syria Kurd force. Turkey is spinning towards Russia and becoming a fundamental Islamic country. Turkey's foreign ministry has summoned a senior U.S. diplomat to express Ankara's discomfort over Washington's support of Syrian Kurdish fighters, state media reported. Citing an anonymous diplomatic source, the Anadolu news agency said the U.S. Embassy Chargé d'Affaires, Philip Nossett, was summoned on Wednesday without offering any further detail. Yeah, the Kurds. What happens to the Kurds? Big question. Our most dependable ally in the region, the Kurds. Second story, top five. 3 months after Baghdad took control, tensions are high in Kirkuk. Why do you think that is? You don't think it could be the whole Sunni-Shiite thing, do you? Well, let's have a read. In a January 4 meeting with a delegation representing Kurdistan's opposition parties, Iraqi Prime Minister Haider al-Abadi said that an agreement has been reached to calm the situation in Kirkuk, in the Kirkuk province, and in the district of Tuz Kormato. The retaking of Kirkuk by Iraqi army in October has changed the balance of power in the oil-rich town, which had been under full control of the Kurds since 2014. The operation was part of Baghdad's retaliatory measures after the Kurds held an independence referendum that has since been declared illegal. In Kirkuk, some signs of the 3 years of Kurdish control have already been erased. Some pictures of Kurds who fell in battles against the Islamic State have been replaced by images of other Iraqis who were killed, and the 20-meter-tall, 65-foot statue of Kurdish Peshmerga fighter on the motorway into the city now has an Iraqi flag. Kirkuk is a mixed city shared by Kurds, Arabs, Turks, and Christians. politically, the Kurds were a majority, held the governor's post, but the deadlock over new elections, power sharing, and the status of the disputed city has remained impossible to break. Since the Iraqi takeover, the departures of the governor and a number of Kurdish politicians have changed the political balance of power. And again, in the aftermath, this is Iraq's path back to being a nation. Is it inclusive? Is it not inclusive? We'll decide whether it has a chance to be a nation. In my own opinion, it is not in their capacity to be inclusive, to form a government of plurals. And so look for more violence in the future. And with the Kurds being in an incredibly precarious situation, and the United States' support of the Kurds in an equally precarious situation. Germany's foreign minister, we are seeing what happens when the U.S. pulls back. In an interview, German Foreign Minister Sigmar Gabriel urges Germany to pay greater attention to the future of the EU. He warned that there are no vacuums in international politics, that when the U.S. withdraws, Russia or China will step in. So the interview is with the magazine Der Spiegel. Duterte, the guy in the Philippines. Philippines-China bond is improving on a daily basis. How about that? We'll see how that works for you. Number five, Taiwan plans to invest in advanced arms as China flexes its muscle. This is always an interesting little dance. This is, again, from Reuters. Taiwan's ruling party plans to use long-term increase in defense spending to pursue advanced weapon systems, government officials say, in what is widely seen as growing determination to forge a stronger deterrent against a Chinese attack. The left-leaning Democratic Party, Progressive Party, led by President Tsai Ing-wen, is working on detailed spending plans through 2025, two officials say. Tsai and her team have met repeatedly with military leaders in a push for new investments in training and equipment, one of the officials said. Immediate priorities include new missile drones, electronic warfare systems, fighter aircraft, ballistic missile defenses, according to a separate statement from the Ministry of National Defense sent to Reuters. So, interesting little dance they do on Taiwan. That's right. There's a surface warfare symposium going on. There's a section of the Early Bird devoted to it. And here's an article from Defense News. Lawmakers tried Navy, DOD on step back from transparency. Two lawmakers who oversee defense policy took aim at years-long walk back of U.S. Navy transparency, calling on the Navy to declassify ship inspection results and end an information chill spurned by U.S. Navy and DOD memos over the past year. The head of the House Sea Power and Projection Forces Subcommittee, in remarks at the Surface Navy's annual symposium, called on the Navy to declassify Board of Inspections, BOI, and survey inspections, known as NSERV, arguments and transparency, would put needed pressure on the Navy to fix long-standing issues. We have recently classified NSERVs, and during peacetime, the question is, do we really need to do that? Said Representative Robert Whitman, a Republican from Virginia. Shouldn't there be some transparency there so we understand what is necessary for those ships? I think that during peacetime, NSERVs should be unclassified so that we know what is going on, and ability for all of us to understand what needs to happen and make sure we stay on a strict cycle for 3 years. Navy's a mess. Bottom line. Let me cut to the chase on that deal. Marine Corps headlines. There's nothing new. Okay, as I said, Yeah, the Marine Corps flying underneath the weather, underneath the radar, underneath the weather. Well, it could fly under both, the weather and the radar. So, yeah, nothing bad going on in the Marine Corps. A little bit of fall to roll, but nothing bad. All right, we're going to take a break. We're going to see if we can get in touch with the gunner today. More of All Marine Radio coming up next. Are you looking for the perfect gift for somebody who's in the military, for a first responder, for a hunter, for an outdoorsman, or somebody that just likes cool military stuff? I've got the perfect gift for you, the Battle Mug. Starts at 10 pounds of aluminum. It's milled, machined, anodized, adorned with Picatinny rails, and then stamped with the serial number, and it's ready for you to make your own. Anything that went on your rifle or pistol can go on your mug. Scope, laser, camera, light. Put a lid on it, and you're ready for the field. If you're inside, add a flag and an emblem, and you're set. Perfect for any commemorative event. Farewell, promotion, retirement, birthday, anniversary, or get out of the doghouse. The Battle Mug is the perfect unique gift. Check out the entire line of product at BattleMug.com. Enter the promo code Marine for 15% off. Battle Mug is a veteran-owned and operated company. The product is made entirely in the United States. Check it out. BattleMug.com.
All you veterans, listen up. This is Bob Nielsen, former Marine and founder of 100 Entrepreneurs Project. Turner Construction is looking for veterans with real-world leadership experience to join their team of professionals.
Hold on, Nielsen. Are we talking about a job or a career?
Mac, Turner Construction is a great company with global opportunities for veteran leaders who are looking to start professional careers. I know. I returned to Turner after I got back from Vietnam and retired after 50 years. I had a great career traveling the world leading teams of Turner employees as we built incredible projects.
Are they looking for me to have construction experience, Bob?
Absolutely not. Turner is looking for leaders who have led under pressure. We want leadership. So if you're led in Iraq or Afghanistan or any other contingency, Turner Construction is actively looking for you.
So, a career with competitive pay, good benefits, and a company seeking veteran leaders. That's what we're talking about.
Bingo. We're on the right road when a grunt can understand it. Good job, Mac.
I appreciate that there, Nelson. How do I get the ball rolling? What do I do?
Just email your resume to jobs@allmarineradio.com, and I will personally contact you and we'll begin the process.
I love it. Turner Construction is looking for veteran leaders who are looking for careers to join their veteran-friendly team. Email Bob Nielsen at jobs@allmarineradio.com. Let's do it.
I'm an individual member. I joined the Global South Foundation because I believe in what it can do, and I also wanted to stay tied to the community that I was part of.
The benefits for individual members of the Global South Foundation are two things. One is networking, keeping in touch with the community, developing new relationships at any stage of your career. And secondly, it helps people stay abreast and up to date on the latest issues that the SOF community should be aware of.
The Global SOF Foundation is a great partner of All Marine Radio. Find out more about them at globalsoftfoundation.org/Marines.
America's injured and critically ill service members face incredible challenges every day of their lives. Since 2004, the Semper Fi Fund has helped thousands of service members and their families with both immediate and long-term needs. Join the Semper Fi Fund in supporting American heroes. They've given so much. Now it's our turn. Learn how your tax-deductible donation makes a real difference in their lives at SemperFiFund.org.
All I can say about MilitaryByOwner.com is, wow, I listed my house on your website for only 2 weeks in a tough rental market, and now my house is about to get rented. I will definitely recommend you guys to everyone in the military. Thank you.
Are you located near a military base? Advertise with Military by Owner for optimum exposure to the military community. Military by Owner has experience helping military families find, sell, or rent their home near a military base for the past 15 years. MilitaryByOwner.com, proven and dependable.
We all have the ability to touch the lives of those around us. Moms, dads, neighbors, teachers, friends. These are the people who are always there to listen when we need to talk. Though their actions may not always be monumental, they are always felt. To someone going through a difficult time, a text, a call, or a visit can mean so much. Reach out to the veterans in your life today. Let them know they're not alone. One simple act can make all the difference. That's the power of one. If you're a veteran in crisis or know one who is, visit VeteransCrisisLine.net for free 24/7 confidential support. Or call 1-800-273-8255 and press 1.